Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Laura Lipman about her new book, The Lady in the Lake. We'll also hear from Lisa Howorth about her second novel, The Summerlings. Lipman is the award-winning New York Times bestselling author of an amazing body of work in crime fiction, both in the Tess Monahan series and such standalones as Sunburn, Wild Lake, After I'm Gone, and The Most Dangerous Thing. We're also very happy to say that she lives in Baltimore and New Orleans. Today we're talking about her 24th book, Lady in the Lake. Laura Lipman, I'm so happy to talk to you.
And I'm always happy to talk to you.
Now, you've drawn from some real-life events for this chilling story of two very different murders.
Yes. There were, in 1969, two real-life murders whose details closely correspond to the ones in the book, and yet the ones in the book are nothing really like what happened in real life, which sounds, I know, strange and contradictory. But in 1969, there was the murder of an 11-year-old girl, and it was covered quite a bit by the papers, as one can imagine. And I was 10 at the time, so I was kind of obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
This story came and went very quickly. Also in 1969, a woman named Shirley Partridge eventually was found in the fountain at the man-made lake at the zoo. And I had never heard a word about that until decades later, when I was a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. And it was one of those stories that would pop up in columns that people wrote about, you know, interesting stories from the old days. And, you know, there was a rewrite man at the Baltimore Sun who called her Lady in the Lake. And it was of interest because it was such a stone-cold mystery. They never even established how she died. And absent that information, they couldn't officially rule it a homicide.
And so you set out to come up with your version of the conclusion to these stories.
I actually set out to write about the year 1966 because after the election of 2016, I couldn't imagine writing about the present day for a while. It seemed a little too crazy and chaotic. That's not a partisan opinion. It just felt like everyone I know, regardless of what they believed, was spending all their time on Twitter.
That's true.
And being upset. And I had seen that there were these really interesting parallels in the presidential election of 2016 and the governor's race in Maryland in 1966, where we also saw an outsider with what I'll call an anti-other message. I'll go ahead. I'll call it a racist message. I don't know why we're tiptoeing around that word so much today. And a more conventional from within the system candidate. The difference is in 1966 is that the outsider with this very racist appeal about segregation and keeping white neighborhoods white was a Democrat. And the Republican he faced off against was Spiro Agnew. And Agnew won because white voters from the Democratic Party and also almost all African-American voters chose to support him over his opponents.
Reading this book is like holding up a prism to the 60s. There's race, there's interracial relationships, feminism, opportunities for women, changing social mores and neighborhoods. It's like it's all in there, Laura. I mean, it's such a canvas of concerns.
But it's also like a mirror. It wasn't uppermost in my mind how timely these things were. But once the book was finished and once I had the privilege of getting to talk to people about it, and they'd say things like, well, of course, today, if a woman disappeared and was found in the fountain, it would be a big story. And I'd say, would it?
Would it?
I still don't think the national media shows much interest in victims who happen to be women of color. I'm not sure you're right about that. And then, you know, people would say, well, of course, post Me Too, you can't imagine a woman whose work life would be like that. I'm like, well, are we sure about that? I happen to have someone in my life who's going through something at their workplace right now. And I thought, people think that we've come to the end of these stories. Unfortunately, no.
Well, tell us about your protagonist, Maddie Morgenstern-Schwartz. She's a kind of golden girl who's fallen on hard times and is looking for a way forward, a way to make a difference in the world.
Maddie was inspired by the titular character in one of my favorite novels, Marjorie Morningstar.
Of course.
If you know the novel, you know after spending over, I think, 600 pages in the point of view of Marjorie, Woke decides to give the final few pages to the now adult man who pined for her when he was a pimply teenager. And we see their meeting from his point of view. And he's like, oh, thank goodness she discouraged me. She's much too old for me. She looks like a grandmother. She's 39.
Right.
And that would have been set in the 50s. And so I had reread that. And I reread it every year. But this is the time that it was like, wait a minute. She's 39. And I thought about, I accept the novel as written, that she is a happily married woman and she's made the right choice. And that the next day, in that version of the story, her life probably goes on as it always has. But I found myself thinking about, well, but we don't know what Marjorie thinks about this meeting. What if, now is the big novelist question.
Yes.
What if she senses a disturbance in the force and she's reminded that, hey, wait a minute, I was going to be somebody. And I married a lovely man, someone I really loved. I've almost, you know, my kid's almost ready to go to college. Who am I? And Maddie Schwartz is 37. Her life has been defined largely by being beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
She has enjoyed the benefits and perhaps also the drawbacks of being a beautiful woman. It's not enough for her anymore. It's not enough to be the calm, unflappable wife who always looks perfect and keeps a perfect house and can throw a last-minute dinner party. She looks around, as the famous line in literature says, and there must be something more. And she bolts her marriage without a plan in place, knowing only that she's going to go out into the world and find a way to matter. That's the word she says over and over and again.
Right.
And eventually she becomes fixated on the idea that she will matter by getting a reporting job at the newspaper where she's found a job as a clerk.
Now, you said that when you started, you didn't know you were going to write a novel about newspapers. And this is a great and very observant one. And I want you to talk about how personal that is to you.
So I'm a second-generation newspaper reporter, or was. My father worked most of his career from 1965 to 1995 at the Baltimore Sun, which at that time, when he joined it in 65, it was quite the grand dame of the Middle Atlantic seaboard. It was a paper with 8 foreign bureaus and a very serious Washington bureau. And my father wrote about the Supreme Court and sometimes went out on the campaign trail with vice presidential candidates. I remember he traveled with both Agnew and Muskie when I was a kid. And I wanted to imagine life at a more raucous afternoon newspaper, and I had, in fact, worked at an afternoon newspaper when I first came to Baltimore in 1989. I worked at the upstart sister paper of the Baltimore Sun, the Evening Sun. And so I knew that life, but I didn't know what newsrooms were like in the 60s. And when I found that I had written my way into a newspaper novel, I thought, okay, I need to get this right. One source for me was one of my father's colleagues, and I emailed with him. My father had died in 2014,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of his colleagues, we lost a lot of his colleagues over the past couple of years as well. Two of my father's best friends died while I was writing this book, and one of them would have been quite beyond helping me even when he was alive. Unfortunately, he had dementia. But one of my father's younger friends, who was up in Massachusetts, we would share emails together, although I think he thought it was funny what I wanted to know, because I didn't need to know about the big stories of the day. I needed to know what day-to-day life was like.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to be reminded that newsrooms were once very noisy, very dirty places. I mean, one thing that was very instructive in writing Lady in the Lake was to go back and reread an essay that Nora Ephron had written about her life at the New York Post.
Mm-hmm.
And she joined there in the early 60s. And, you know, there are just these little details that remind you of what newsrooms used to be like. And I've always felt that the danger of writing a newspaper novel when you used to work in a newspaper is there'll be too much information and you'll over-romanticize it. And it'll just get bogged down with things that a journalist finds fascinating, but nobody else does. So that was my big fear about writing a newspaper novel. But, you know, once I got Maddie inside the newsroom, it just made sense. I surrendered to my novel's will. It was like, this is the only thing that makes sense. I mean, the big question in writing this book is, how are these two deaths going to be connected when they're clearly not connected? You know, I didn't want to write some crazy, twisty serial killer novel where it turns out that a person who kills an 11-year-old girl is also the person who killed the Lady in the Lake, and there's some vast conspiracy involving, you know. That's not the kind of book I write. And so Maddie's the connection, and how can Maddie connect them unless she becomes a reporter, unless she becomes interested in both cases for very different personal reasons? So last year about this time, about a month before now, my editors had said, boy, it would really be great if you could finish this novel by July 1st. And I finished it by June 27th. And the next day I packed up my car, my kid, who was 8 at the time, and we headed to the beach where my mother lives. And this means that you drive east from Baltimore over the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. You go right past the state capital of Annapolis, and we were about halfway through the journey when I stopped at a Burger King, called my mom and said, hey, we're about 90 minutes away. We've had lunch. We'll see you pretty soon. And my mom said, did you get caught in traffic in Annapolis? I said, no, why would that happen? It's the middle of the day. And she said, oh, there's been a shooting. And in that next millisecond or so, when I said, where, I couldn't have been more casual, which is a horrible thing to say, but I'm being truthful. In that moment when I said to my mother, where, it never occurred to me to think that I would be connected to what she was about to tell me, and it didn't occur to me just how numb I had become to the phenomenon of public mass shootings. And my mother said it was the newspaper, and my mother didn't know that one of my former son colleagues, one of my favorite people that I've ever worked with, had gone to work at the Annapolis Capital Gazette, and Rob Hyacin was one of the five people killed that day. And I dedicated this book to him and all of them because I loved being a novelist. I liked being a newspaper reporter. But I also always appreciated that I really did get to know what H.L. Mencken called the life of kings. I got into journalism when it was still fun. Because that was the covenant, right?
Yeah.
It took a little less money than you might have if you went into corporate public relations or some kind of communications gig, but you had fun. You had fun. You had stories. You had the best coworkers. And so I felt like I had 20 years of that, and I was so lucky. And then I got to go off and have my dream job, and I was so lucky. And I really couldn't believe that Rob and his coworkers had died that way. I do think that they were victims of a coarsened, heightened rhetoric. And people who are very literal will say, no, the man who was accused of the shooting, his grudge against the newspaper went back many years. You can't blame the way people are talking now about fake news and the enemy of the people. But I can, and I do. I say to people who want to argue with me about this, I'm like, do you want to tell me that words don't matter? I've spent an entire adult lifetime committed to the idea that words matter, whether they're journalism or fiction. Of course I think words matter. Of course I think they affect people. So, yeah, I think my friend and his colleagues were victims indirectly of hate speech.
I do too. And you honor them with this book. This book says so much about how we live now, how we live then. And it is such a great newspaper novel. It really, really is. We've been talking with Laura Lippman, whose most recent book is The Lady in the Lake. You can meet her Tuesday, August 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Laura, thank you so much.
Susan, it is always a pleasure, and you know it's always a pleasure when I get to be in New Orleans, so I'm so happy I'm coming back.
Welcome home. All right, take care and safe travels, you. Thank you so much. Lisa Hulworth was born in Washington, D.C., which was her family's home for four generations, and it's the setting of her new novel. Lisa has written about all kinds of subjects for Garden and Gun and the Oxford American, and she's the author of an earlier novel, Flying Shoes. She and her husband, Richard Hulworth, founded the legendary Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi in 1979. Now there's something to celebrate, too. And today we're talking about her charming new novel, The Summerlings. Lisa Hulworth, I'm so happy to talk with you.
I'm so happy to talk with you again, if I may say so.
Oh, yes.
From the little easy to the big easy, my favorite city in the world.
Well, we're looking forward to you coming back. Now, this novel is such a charmer. It's set in 1959, and it's set on a Washington street called Connor's Lane, where a number of families are trying to cope with post-World War II life. And reading it reminded me how much I love summer novels. They're kind of a special genre, aren't they?
I think they are, yeah. Although that's kind of been pointed out to me since I wrote this book. And then I realized, yes, I love them too.
So. I know, it's funny. I always think of those great scenes in To Kill a Mockingbird set in the summertime.
Right, of course.
You know, so tell us about the Summerlings. Tell us who they are.
The Summerlings are essentially three young boys, 8, 9, and they have one girl friend who's not quite central to the whole thing, but is very much involved. And she is a daughter of a Latin American diplomat. And they are essentially trying to make sense of this one particular summer. The narrator is John, one of the little boys, as an adult looking back on this particular summer of 1959 that was very cataclysmic to the boys and to the neighborhood. And the boys are basically trying to deal with the usual issues of growing up, sex and bullying and adult dysfunction in their families. And, of course, the bigger issue of the late 50s, Cold War issues, and their neighborhood has been kind of divided or not quite. There's not a lot of warmth in the neighborhood, basically because of what you did in the war had a lot to do with the way the families feel about each other. And there's some animosity because it's a neighborhood like the one I grew up in, which was Chevy Chase, just across the district line.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's father was perhaps a CIA operative, and there were Ukrainians, diplomats and Latin American diplomats, and there was a Jewish family that had escaped Austria after Anschluss, and then there's a Dutch general who is a Nazi sympathizer who, for some odd reason, at least to the children, why is he hiding out in the United States? But it was a very mixed, unusual neighborhood, which I didn't really realize until much later in life. It dawned on me what an unusual neighborhood it was. All we knew was it was our hood.
Well, it was such a complex political time with old feelings and suspicions, and everyone still has those terrible memories to cope with.
Yeah, exactly. And the boys are learning about some of those things and just not quite sure what to do with it all. And they sort of compress all their anxieties into issues that are basically about themselves.
Of course.
Serving. The problems in the neighborhood they resent, not because they represent any moral authority or moral problems, but because it keeps them from swimming in somebody's swimming pool or for going in somebody's backyard or those kinds of, you know, typical neighborhood issues, but they're really grounded in graver problems.
Well, it's great to rediscover that summer world through a kid's eyes and to strip things down to their basics. And John and Ivan and Max plan a fabulous family fiesta based on what they call the Beaver Plan. So tell us about the Beaver Plan.
The Beaver Plan is something that one of the several projects they get into this particular summer, but the Beaver Plan was meant to instill neighborhood reunification and make everybody be nice to each other the way they had seen it on Leave It to Beaver. And their model is what they vaguely know from reading their weekly readers about the Marshall Plan. There's not a whole lot of similarities between the two, but they, of course, decide they're going to have a big party, and that'll bring everybody together.
Now, this book, I mean, it is a charmer on the surface, but for all its charm, it's really deep and clear. I mean, it's a novel of lost innocence in every way. John's parents are divorced. The neighborhood and the country are on the verge of so much change. And it was a time, it seems to me, when America was coming of age, as well as these boys. And it's about to hit the tipping point of the 60s.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. It was kind of the last gasp of this innocence and this brief little more than a decade since World War II and the stuff that was about to hit the fan in 1960 and there on out. There were these years of, hope and relief about the war being over and that things are going to get better, but it happened otherwise. Khrushchev, the Russian leaders, had been war heroes and allies, and all of a sudden, they were our biggest enemies. And, of course, they had the bomb. That was an enormous thing for people to face at that time. You know, not unlike the way we have to worry about terrorism now, sort of the same thing. I imagine for children, they're terrified of that, the way we were terrified of nuclear war. But, yeah, it was the last gasp of a kind of innocence, and the 60s couldn't have been more different in so many ways. And, you know, there were so many changes so quickly.
I know. When I think about them riding around Washington on their bikes late at night, I think, not now. That would never happen now.
No, I mean, it probably does happen, but then it was something that, you know, was not that unusual. I mean, we did it. But that's another thing that fascinated me was, now that I have grandchildren, I'm thinking about how much children's lives have changed since I was a child and since my grandchildren are, you know, children. I had so much freedom. We had so much freedom. These little boys had so much freedom. I mean, you leave the house in the morning.
Be outside all day.
Maybe you'd come home and make yourself a sandwich. Maybe not. You'd go get candy at the store and eat that for lunch, or... And, you'd have to be home at dinner, and then you'd be back out in, you know, the night, at least it's summer. We had so much freedom. So, I mean, I suppose lots of places it's still like that, but even in Oxford it's not like that anymore.
Right.
So, I don't know. I was interested in talking about that.
Well, it's kind of fun to be 8 and 9 years old again with you.
It was fun because... You know, you remember certain things that you think that'd be fun to write about, but the more you get into it, the more you remember, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that we did that, or, you know, that so-and-so's parents were doing that, and it's really wild. So.
Well, I love that. Life went on as it will. That summer stayed with me. Surreal footage that seemed more and more like a movie with every passing day. We kids were merely flotsam and jetsam on the crazy river that life is, and even though we'd hit the white water of the adult world, we'd come up, bobbing along, but never again quite so buoyant. I love that, Lisa, so much.
Thank you.
So, this is a great book. That's all.
Yeah, there was so much to explore in here, and so much that was so fun to write. Writing my first book was, although there's a lot of humor in it, and a lot of craziness and fun stuff. The backstory is about, you know, my brother's still unsolved murder, and it was really hard to write and not very much fun a lot of the time. So this one was just really pure fun and memories and making up stuff that amused me, and also getting to talk about the pop culture of the 50s. I mean,
oh yeah, You got the music perfectly.
Yeah, the music.
I love that.
And the films and kids games and cars and, you know, all cars look alike these days. Why is that? Back then, everything was just a little work of art. I don't know. But that was a whole lot of fun for me. So.
Well, and it's a lot of fun for the reader, too.
Well, I hope that older readers, boomers, will enjoy remembering, and that maybe some young readers will enjoy learning about a period of American life that was pretty fascinating, and that also people may feel that when things do get really terrible, we've been through terrible times before, and we will come through, I hope.
I hope so, too.
Right.
It's very consoling to think that.
Good. I'm glad.
Oh, we've been talking with Lisa Howorth, whose wonderful new novel is The Summerlings. You can meet her Thursday, August 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and cotton is high.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Poet Molly Kirshner reads Sunday, August 4th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Laura Lippman discusses and signs Lady in the Lake, Tuesday, August 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents a panel discussion, Separate and Unequal, African American Struggle for Schooling Before and After the Civil War. It brings together writers and scholars illuminating the unique relationship between race and education in New Orleans. Moderated by David Robinson Morris, founding director of the Center for Equity, Justice, and the Human Spirit at Xavier University, the panel features Fatima Sheikh, author of What Went Missing and What Got Found, Daniel Brook, author of An Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, and historian Walter Stern, author of Race and Education in New Orleans, Creating the Segregated City, 1764 to 1960. The event takes place August 7th at 6 at the Williams Research Center, 410 Charters. Lisa Howorth discusses and signs The Summerlings, Thursday, August 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Sam J. Miller discusses and signs his fantasy novel, Destroy All Monsters, Friday, August 9th at 6 at Pearl Wine Company, 3700 Orleans Avenue. Kathy Finn discusses and signs Tom Benson, A Billionaire's Journey, Saturday, August 10th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Ron Calamia discusses and signs Fantastic Saints, Saturday, August 10th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.